who's next in line? And which groups of Florida residents could soon have access to the COVID vaccine? Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. And just ahead, we've got the very latest on the state's vaccination rollout. What are your questions? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, some positive news and notes for your midweek. It's our What's Good Wednesdays. But first this hour, the latest on the pandemic around the state. Tuesday, Florida health officials reported that statewide, we now have a cumulative case count of COVID of 1.87 million. Hospitalizations and deaths are up again overnight. But here's another number. About 2.74 million Florida residents have now received at least one dose of the COVID vaccine. That's good news. However, Florida is the only state that hasn't yet told its residents who will get shots next and when more doses will be available. That according to a new analysis of state rollouts by the Kaiser Family Foundation. Instead, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has been laser focused on vaccinating only seniors and telling all other groups to wait their turn. Now, the governor did say Tuesday that he would like four new federal vaccine sites that are opening across the state next month to serve teachers and law enforcement officers who are aged 50 and older. Dr. Michael Corrin with the Jacksonville Center for Clinical Research is a cardiologist and a COVID-19 researcher. He has conducted vaccine trials in our area, and he has some new insights this morning. Dr. Corrin, always good to have your expertise. Good morning.
Well, thanks for inviting me, and thanks for being part of this important breaking news today.
And give us a call as we talk about the next phase of COVID vaccination rollout in Florida. What are your questions? 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page is open. So what's your reaction, Doctor, to the governor's comments Tuesday that he wants teachers and law enforcement officials over age 50 to be next in line to receive vaccinations?
Okay. My reaction?
Yeah.
Yeah. So one of the, every virus has its specific characterizations. And the thing about COVID-19 that is very, very clear is it has a disproportionate effect on older people. When you look at the data, the likelihood of somebody dying of COVID-19 infection if you're 25 years or less is about 1 in 5,000. If you're in your 50s and 60s, the likelihood of dying is about 1 in 40 or 1 in 50. And when you get into the 80s, your likelihood of dying is about 1 in 4. So I actually like policies that are focused on protecting the most vulnerable, which in the case of this particular virus are older people. And I think our governor has done a good job of focusing on the people who are most vulnerable. So kudos to that.
Mm-hmm. And then what about the governor saying next in line should be teachers and law enforcement officials who are age 50 and up?
Makes sense. Certainly makes sense. Certainly we need to make sure that people who have a public-facing role are protected. There's been a lot of discussion about how to get schools open safely, and having teachers protected through the vaccines is a great way of doing it. And I have quite a few patients who are in law enforcement, and they certainly have their concerns about their public-facing roles, and I love the fact that they will get priority. So I'm very supportive of that.
Supportive of that. And let me ask you your reaction, Doctor, to this new analysis out today from the Kaiser Family Foundation saying that Florida isn't the only state that has been transparent about the next steps, who will get shots next, when more doses will be available. But they've been critical of the flow of information in this state about COVID vaccinations. What are your thoughts?
I haven't looked at that report, so it's hard for me to really comment on it. As I mentioned, overall, I've been very supportive of what's been done in Florida. And I look at the numbers comparing Florida to other states around the country. And we've had an average number of overall infections per capita, but actually slightly less than average number of deaths per capita, despite the fact that we have a fair number of older people in the state. So I think that is a nice statement saying that we've done a reasonably good job in the state. You compare that to some other states that have had, you know, much higher rate of deaths with the same number of infections. So the possibilities to explain that are differentials in care once people get sick, which I don't think is the answer. I think it's more likely has to do with the demographics, the people who are getting infected. So I haven't looked at the Kaiser report specifically. I will do that.
Sure.
But overall, I think Florida's done a good job. The one place where I think there's room for debate, and this is a very, very interesting question, and states handle this differently, is whether or not you prioritize giving everybody their first dose of the vaccine versus making sure that everybody gets two doses of the messenger RNA vaccine. And Florida has made a decision to hold doses of vaccine so that once somebody is vaccinated with their first dose, they can get the second dose either 21 days later or 28 days later, depending if it's Pfizer or Moderna. Some other states have said, okay, whatever doses we have, we're going to give out, and we'll worry about the timing of the second dose whenever that supply comes to our availability. So that's a reasonable debate. I would actually make the argument that there may be some rationale in getting more first doses done, because even the messenger RNA vaccines seem to have pretty good protection about 7 to 10 days after the first dose. But that's an interesting internal debate for policy folks, and something that we'll learn more about as more states make their decisions and we see how it affects their populace.
We'll go to your calls in a moment for Dr. Michael Corin of the Jacksonville Center for Clinical Research. He has conducted COVID vaccine trials in our area. 549-2937. Dr. Corin, Johnson & Johnson's single-dose vaccine is protective against COVID-19, according to U.S. regulators. So that sets the stage for a final decision on another vaccination shot being widely available. I know you conducted a Pfizer clinical trial in Jacksonville. What do you think about the Johnson & Johnson product?
Well, exciting news. Big news for today. As a matter of fact, the briefing document for the Johnson & Johnson vaccine program literally just came out within the hour. And as I was waiting to speak with you, I was trying to look it up. So I haven't actually had a chance to review it. But we do know that this will be most likely the third vaccine that has emergency authorization. And I'll explain what that means in a second. That Johnson & Johnson will now be another manufacturer that produces vaccines for the country, so more people will have more access to vaccines. And that there are some distribution advantages of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine versus the others. So I've been personally involved in the Pfizer program as a principal investigator, in the Moderna program as a principal investigator, and in the Novavax program as a secondary investigator, working with Dr. Jeff Jackmine here in Jacksonville. And we have not worked specifically with the Johnson & Johnson, but I am familiar with it. It uses a different, Johnson & Johnson uses a different platform than the others in that it is a modified adenovirus that cannot reproduce itself, but that can express proteins of COVID-19. So it differs from the other vaccines that we've talked about in that it actually does involve injecting a virus. But because of the stability of the platform, it doesn't need to be frozen when it's shipped. So a big advantage compared to the others is that this will be distributed refrigerated rather than frozen. It should have a longer shelf life than the others, and it only requires one dose rather than two for the messenger RNA vaccines, which are Pfizer and Moderna. So the hope is that it'll be more broadly distributed because of the simpler distribution requirements for that particular vaccine. The downside, and again, I'm really anxious to review the briefing document in detail, but so far what we know, the downside is that the vaccine is probably not quite as effective as the messenger RNA vaccines. And what we're really looking for in the briefing document is to see if there are any safety signals of concern based on the fact that it's an entire virus that's being injected into somebody again, a virus that can't reproduce itself, but nonetheless a more complicated biological material than, say, the messenger RNA vaccines, which are very, very simple messages of material that tells our bodies what to do.
Thanks for that distinction. Let's go to your calls now. We're speaking with Dr. Michael Corin of the Jacksonville Center for Clinical Research. He has conducted COVID vaccination trials here in our area. And as more vaccine supply is coming into the First Coast, we want to hear from you. Have you been vaccinated? Are you waiting your turn? Are you maybe someone who waited late at night to see if you could get an unused dose at one of the vaccination sites? We've been hearing about that happening too, because they don't want to throw away unused vaccine. They want to get it into arms rather than throw it out. 549-2937. Nick is in St. Augustine. Hi, Nick. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I did have a question for the doctor.
Yeah, go ahead.
I just wanted his opinion on, I'm 64 and a half, and I have three immune deficiencies, and I'm also taking a biologic, Humira, and I'm not able to get a vaccine, even with a letter from my doctor associated with the local hospital in St. Augustine. I called the hospital, and they're not giving the vaccine yet, or they said they weren't. So I turned 65 in July, but I just wanted to see what his opinion was about people like me.
Right. What should Nick do, Dr. Korn? Nick, thanks for your call, and sorry you're in that position right now. Like so many others, doctor, what do you advise Nick to do?
Sure. So Nick would be an example of somebody who would actually not participate in the clinical trials that we ran, in whom a patient who should have a nice discussion with his or her physician to decide whether or not they're an appropriate candidate for the vaccines. So in any clinical trial, there are people who get excluded for a number of different reasons. And for both the Pfizer and Moderna trials, we excluded people that have immune deficiencies or who are on drugs that would suppress the immune system, such as Humira. Having said that, every person is an individual, and your physician would know you best, and they would have to make a decision with you as to whether or not they felt that the risk of the vaccine, either the risk of causing a side effect or the risk of not working as well as it should, outweighs the protection that you would get against COVID-19. Of course, if you're immunosuppressed due to a medicine, you're also at higher risk potentially for the effects of the virus. So these get into, you know, very specific decisions that patients should make with their physicians. And once that decision is made, then I think the system should be supportive of that. And I know personally, I've written a number of letters for my patients to get vaccinated who may have some of these type of concerning issues. And by and large, I've not heard any feedback that those letters haven't been accepted. So, you know, as there's more and more available, the vaccines, and people become more aware of the fact that not everybody fits into a clear category, hopefully these things will settle themselves out.
And let me jump in and ask, the Biden administration is pledging hundreds of millions of doses. What are you hearing from your contacts about that? What do you think the timetable will be for the majority of us to be vaccinated?
I think there's going to be a marked increase in the number of doses available. We're already seeing it. Again, the manufacturing facilities for both Pfizer and Moderna are being expanded and have successfully increased their number successfully increased their output. Johnson & Johnson, once they become part of the supply chain, should also add millions of doses. They were hopeful to add 100 million doses within 6 weeks or so, and they've backed off. Johnson & Johnson has backed off on that number a little bit, but you know, all three manufacturers, hopefully by next week, will be producing at, you know, high levels and making the vaccine much more available.
Kendra in Mandarin. Hi, Kendra. So did you receive the vaccine?
Yes, I did.
Okay, tell us about it.
Well, I received an email from MD Anderson because I'm a breast cancer survivor under the age of 65. And I went to Baptist South about a week ago, and they've got an entire floor in one of their office buildings totally dedicated to it. It was really efficient. I was in and out in about 8 minutes, plus you self-monitor for about 15 more. And it was just exemplary. I felt so grateful to get it.
I'm so glad. I'm so glad, Kendra. Glad to hear it. And, you know, Dr. Korn, I've also heard that UF Health has sent out an email to its patients that they have a limited supply for people that are younger than 65. You know, there are people outside the official categories who are starting to get the shot. Let me ask you about this, too. Here's a comment on our Facebook page. This is people that wait at the end of the day in hopes of getting an unused dose. That's been happening. Marcus writes on Facebook, I waited in line 2 days ago from 4:15 to 5 at Regency. I was there with dozens of people of all ages, races, and genders. People want the vaccine. And we're over a year into this thing, and it's still a logistical nightmare, he says. When can I, as a senior caregiver and my girlfriend, a teacher, get this vaccine? What do you think about this, doctor? People who show up at vaccination sites and hope that they might get lucky at the end of the day and get a healthcare worker to vaccinate them because they don't want to throw out the unused vaccines if people don't show up for appointments.
Sure. Yeah, I've heard lots of mixed things. I, of course, see many hundreds of patients, and some have told me that they've gotten lucky and have gotten vaccines. Some have said they've gotten lucky and got them relatively easily. People have signed up for vaccines through different chain pharmacies. I've heard people mention Walmart, Publix, Winn-Dixie, and being successful signing up through those systems. I've heard people that have got lucky at the hospitals and were able to be part of it. The hospitals have reached out to their patient populations as well as to physician practices who use their facilities, and you know, quite a few people have been able to be vaccinated through those mechanisms. So more and more I'm hearing more positive stories about access to the vaccine, and that's terrific. I think those stories will continue to grow as there's more availability over the course of the next month.
Let's hope so. Here's an email from Alan. He writes, the governor of Connecticut said everyone over age 65 is eligible. We've had that in Florida. But apparently he says in Connecticut, on March 1st, vaccine eligible groups expand to age 55 and over. On March 22nd, age 45 to 55. On April 12th, age 35 to 44, and so on. Does your guest think the governor of Florida should implement a similar schedule? What do you think, doctor?
I think the governor will. I think that, again, as the vaccine becomes more and more available, it'll be easier to make these decisions. The flip side of these things are that you promise people things, and then the manufacturers don't deliver as many doses as you expect, and you have people who are disappointed. So it's a hard job, and as I start my comments, I think by far and away the most important thing is that people who are older, meaning over 65, are universally protected. When we get to a point where virtually everybody in that age group has been vaccinated, I think probably the biggest chunk of prediction is actually done, because as I mentioned, the nature of this virus is that it tends to be a more benign illness as you get younger. But responding to the point, the availability of vaccines will make this all much, much easier. So you can certainly quibble with whether or not we should have a very strict schedule about when people will be able to get it based on their age. But the truth is that as vaccines become available, it'll get easier and easier. And from the, quote, political standpoint, do you wait until you know you have the supply, or do you make promises hoping that you'll have the supply? Mm-hmm. And certainly that's something that I would necessarily be able to comment on, because I don't know how reliable the supplies are in terms of the exact numbers that the health officials are getting.
Jane in Ponte Vedra Beach. Hi, Jane. Thanks for holding. You're on the air.
Hi. I just have a question about the Novavax trial. I'm part of the Novavax trial here in Jacksonville. Had the two first shots, and then didn't know if it was blind or, if I was getting the vaccine. And I'm going back now in March to get two shots. Just wondered if you could address the Novavax trial, and as a 78-year-old, I'm curious. I've waited to get the actual vaccine because I'm part of the trial.
Wow, interesting. And Jane, yeah, it's so interesting to hear from these clinical trial volunteers like Jane, doctor, and you've been working with a lot of these folks too, people that raise their hands and participate in this important research. What about this one?
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you for participating. That's tremendous, and we appreciate your efforts. Just to have the listeners understand more about Novavax, Novavax uses a very interesting mechanism of protection, which is that they have genetically engineered the spike protein from COVID-19, and they combine that with something called an adjuvant. which presents that protein to the immune system. And using this technology, very, very small quantities of the spike protein are able to create an immune response. Novavax is a U.S. company, but they did their first studies overseas and have published that data. And part of that publication of data are information about the effectiveness of the vaccine against the U.K. and the South African variants, which is obviously really important, a question that comes up quite a bit. In the Novavax study, this particular caller has a 2 out of 3 chance of getting the active vaccine immediately upon enrollment in the study, and then a 1 out of 3 chance of getting the vaccine in a delayed fashion, which will be probably about 2 to 3 months after the initial vaccination. It is a blinded study, so people in the trial don't know if they were the early recipients of the vaccine or if they get it later.
Yeah, yeah. And at what point do they unblind people with these types of studies?
In the Novavax trial, there is a crossover, that's a medical word that we use, when people will go to the other arm of the study, again, not knowing if they got it in the beginning or if they got it after 2 or 3 months. And the other part of the Novavax study is that, again, if you have a very, very compelling reason to get vaccinated earlier rather than later, please let the study staff know, and we can have a discussion about that. But the standard part of the trial, it involves this crossover in which everybody will eventually get the vaccine, but you won't know if you get it immediately or after 2 or 3 months.
We are speaking, if you're just tuning in, with Dr. Michael Corrin of the Jacksonville Center for Clinical Research, always a valued subject matter expert on this program. Dr. Corrin has conducted COVID vaccination clinical trials in our area. And as we update you on some important news, the FDA has declared the new Johnson & Johnson vaccine safe and effective against the virus. We also want to let you know, if you are age 65 and older, you can go to the Regency Mall today and get your first COVID shot with no appointment. They are telling people to just show up and get vaccinated, no appointment necessary. And if you've already received your first jab and it has been 19 days or more, you can go today and get your second shot, no appointment. You know, Dr. Corrin, that says to me that they're really having to work hard to get the word out and get people in and get them vaccinated. And we're doing that pretty much every day on this program too, trying to get the word out so that more seniors can show up. They don't even need an appointment at that site.
That's fabulous. I love that. And again, thank you for your work, Melissa, letting people know about the availability of these products and how important that is. It's really tremendous, and local media has done a fabulous job. That's a really good sign that what you just mentioned means that we are getting availability of vaccines and that hopefully that will continue to grow so that we can expand the group of patients who will get access to the vaccine.
Right. And a new federal vaccination site is opening next week at the Gateway Town Center. They are expected to vaccinate as many as 3,000 people a day there. Let's get a few more calls in for Dr. Michael Corrin, 549-2937. Lee up in Kingsland, Georgia. Hi, Lee. I know you've been holding a little bit, so thank you. Go ahead.
Hey, so I'm in the Navy, and they're giving us the option to get the shot, but I have a pending surgery of an L5S1 surgery to be done anteriorly. Should I wait to get the vaccine just in case, or should I go ahead and do the volunteer and get it?
Thank you, Lee. What should Lee do, Michael Corrin?
Obviously, I don't know your case completely, Lee, so I wouldn't give you any medical advice over the telephone. But I will say, as a general sense, that having an upcoming surgery should not be any specific reason not to get the vaccine. But that's definitely a decision that needs to be made with your physician based on the details of your particular case.
Right. Talk to your doctor, Lee. Benjamin in San Marco. Hi, Benjamin.
Hi. Good morning, beautiful. Thank you all for your work. Yes, this is Benjamin Franklin in San Marco.
Okay. Benjamin, you're back from the dead. That's so exciting. Glad to see that you're so hale and hearty after hundreds of years.
Yes. There was a local talk show, Herman Cain, that went to a large Trump event last summer, and then he died after getting COVID. And then they said there were a large number of people that got it at the riot in January. Do you see any connection to big groups like the Super Bowl? Are they seeing a spike in numbers because of that mass event?
Okay. Super spreader events. And you know, Dr. Corin, let's take a moment, too, to talk about how even with more vaccine, we still need to observe safety behaviors like masking and distancing.
Absolutely. So, yeah, there's a couple of interesting comments that I can make. One is that overall in the country, we seem to have hit our highest numbers in late December and early January. And those numbers have come down fairly dramatically over the course of the last 4 or 5 weeks. So, you know, in the state of Florida, we're running about 5,000 or 6,000 cases a day versus a peak that was closer to 15,000 a day. So that's a nice improvement, despite the fact that we did host the Super Bowl a couple weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And that we're seeing that in many, many places in the country. Of course, sometimes you do have regional outbreaks and places that have spikes, but overall, the numbers have come down. And I'm actually more optimistic than a lot of other physicians that I've heard, although you're starting to hear more and more optimistic voices that we're slowly but surely getting to that important herd immunity mark. And if you look at previous pandemics, you see that you can go from peak to very low levels of cases within about 10 weeks. And it looks like we peaked in the, quote, third wave, again, in the time frame of very late December and early January. So based on what we've seen in previous pandemics, I'm predicting that we'll feel a lot more normal in April as the numbers continue to come down and we are at herd immunity or close to it. And I can talk a little bit more about that if there's interest. But
yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. So if you look at what herd immunity means, and there's a little bit of a debate about it, but herd immunity is when the majority, the vast majority of the population is no longer able to get infected. And you develop herd immunity based on either having the virus previously and being immune or getting the vaccine and being immune. Or the third mechanism is that you've been previously exposed to a similar virus and your natural immunity is such that you're protected against the new variant or the slightly different type of virus. So coronaviruses, just to remind everybody, are ubiquitous. Most coronaviruses do not cause severe disease in humans. And it's possible that previous exposure to more benign coronaviruses has some protective effects for certain people. So with all that, my prediction is that we're probably at about 40% immunity in the state of Florida right now. And with the rollout of the vaccines going better and better, and, of course, with the cases of people who recover, we're probably going to be at that 70% mark, in my opinion, in early April. Mm. And at that point, you should see numbers come down, you know, really fairly dramatically. And people will, I think, feel overall a lot more comfortable about going out in public and interacting.
Oh, that is so great to hear. But yeah, there's a but. You said but.
Yep, there's a but. Yeah, so the big but there is we're still a little uncertain how these variants will play out. And whether or not the immunity that is related to what we call the wild-type coronavirus will translate to these variants. I'm actually still pretty optimistic about that, but that's an unknown. Mm-hmm. And then other factors is that just because we are doing better in terms of numbers doesn't mean that we should be promoting reckless behavior, because even if a good percentage of the population is immune, there will be people who are still vulnerable. And you'll see increases in the numbers if there's a dropping of all these very important protective mechanisms such as social distancing, washing your hands, wearing a mask, and just being generally mindful of the fact that even if you're vaccinated, there's still the possibility that you can spread the virus because, again, you may be personally protected, but if somebody with the virus sneezes on you and you wipe your face and then you touch somebody else, you can actually transmit it to somebody who is vulnerable.
That's right. Let's continue to be careful. And always so great to get your insights. I want to thank you for appearing on short notice today so much. Dr. Michael Corin, Jacksonville Center for Clinical Research. Thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure. My pleasure. And keep up the good work. Thank you.
Thank you. You too. Again, let me say this one more time. If you are age 65 and older and have yet to get your vaccine, go to the Regency Mall today. You can be vaccinated there with your first shot with no appointment. If you still need your second shot and it's been 19 days since you've received your first one, go to the Regency Mall today and you can get your second dose. No appointment necessary. And much more coming up today. Later, we've got some good news for your midweek, but up next.
Frankly, during the last year, despite all of the pandemic, we didn't miss a beat. In fact, if anything, we probably had our best year ever.
We'll tell you why the North Florida Land Trust is on a roll. That's next. A local organization is racking up win after win in their mission to conserve environmentally sensitive property in North Florida from development, saving thousands of acres that need ecological protection. I spoke about it with Jim McCarthy, who heads up the North Florida Land Trust. Jim McCarthy, good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Great to talk to you, Melissa.
I've been wanting to check in with you for a while. The North Florida Land Trust is a really active organization, and the mission is so important because you really have made a big footprint in acquiring conservation lands over the years all across this listening area. So bring us up to date. Tell us about what you've been up to.
Well, we frankly, during the last year, despite all of the pandemic, we didn't miss a beat. In fact, if anything, we probably had our best year ever. Perhaps not in terms of number of acres, but in terms of impact. We've been working very closely with actually at both ends of our service area. We service, as you know, from Nassau County down to Volusia County and then west to Lake City. And we've had a number of accomplishments. We are working with three cities, the city of Jacksonville, actually handling the real estate for McCoy's Creek. So we're in consultation with them and talking to the landowners and doing all the due diligence that's required for McCoy's Creek. That's part of the Green Emerald Trail project. Mm-hmm. So we're very excited about that. Working with the city of Fernandina Beach, and acquiring property for them, usually smaller lots, the typical community conservation efforts that you would normally look for. We just finished a conservation land acquisition management program for Nassau County, and they call it CLAM, C-L-A-M. Hmm. And it prioritized the environmentally sensitive land in the county, and established a committee actually in a process that they'll go through to nominate lands and to have them preserved going forward. So that's very exciting, actually, as part of what we would call strategic conservation planning. And then in addition, on the southern end, we have a contract with the city of New Smyrna Beach, and we've been acquiring property along Turnbull Creek, part of their acquisition program down there for the city. That's been really very exciting. So we're working very closely with a number of local governments. We've been talking a little bit with Clay County, a little bit with St. John's about conceivably doing another strategic plan there. We'll see how that kind of comes out to pass. And then, of course, our biggest initiative at the moment is the American Beach, where we want to, frankly, we want to be part of the revitalization of American Beach. I suspect many of your listeners already know about American mm-hmm. Beach, but for those that don't, it was the only beach that Black Americans could go to during the Jim Crow era. In fact, my banker on the day we signed the note to buy the property up there, which was a scary experience, by the way, to borrow money to buy property for us. But we don't do it often. That's the second time. But we borrowed money to buy the property on American Beach. And my banker, who was handling it, has a personal connection. When her ex-husband's family used to come south, that was the only place where they could put in their boat on the entire East Coast when they come down from Maryland. That American Beach was the only beach that would welcome African Americans.
Wow.
It's got a tremendous history, particularly if you're into music, and I am. I'm a big Louis Armstrong, Cab Calloway, all those folks, just Ray Charles, all those musicians used to play up there. It was a vibrant area. It's incredibly historic.
Oh yeah, the history is amazing there. It needs its own museum and tourist attraction. I mean, absolutely.
It does.
Well, Jim,
there's a small museum up there, but you're right. We need to revitalize that area. We need to restore the Rendezvous and get it back to the glory days.
Yeah, that was the old club or honky-tonk, whatever.
Yeah.
You just laid out a dizzying array of projects that you're working on at the North Florida Land Trust. I would think if you added them all up, you've conserved or are going to conserve thousands of acres of land in this area. And what you do is, by buying it up, you're protecting it from development, essentially. Can you talk about this mission and why it's so important?
Well, it's critically important, and I'm glad you brought that up. Last year, we got close to, I haven't seen the final numbers, but we're close to conserving 30,000 acres of land in North Florida. That's a lot of land, and it's incredibly important to us, and it's, oddly enough, it's incredibly important not only for environmental reasons, but economic development reasons. If you talk to Andre Wallace at Jacks USA and ask him why the number one reason the businesses are locating to Jacksonville, he'll tell you it's our natural resources. If you go to the Visit Jacksonville website or the Visit Florida website, what you'll see is they're advertising our natural resources. People move here for our river, for our streams, for our creeks, for our lakes, for our beaches. That's what they're coming here for. So if you want them to keep coming from an economic development standpoint, we need to continue to preserve those natural resources. In addition, we need to conserve land so that we can protect our aquifer recharge areas. Those areas where folks may think that we get most of our water out of the St. Johns, and the reality is that our water comes out of the aquifer. And most of the rain that falls in the North Florida actually runs off into creeks and streams and into our river and eventually into the St. Johns and out of the ocean. But there are aquifer recharge areas, particularly those most folks will identify with Keystone Heights, where there are aquifer recharge areas. When it rains there, that water filters through the soils and into the aquifer and recharge that aquifer. There, southern part of Clay County, southwest St. Johns, a lot of Putnam County, most of western Flagler County are great water aquifer recharge areas. Those need to be protected, because if not, we're going to have to find another man-made way of getting water, which is, it just doesn't make sense. It's particularly more expensive to do it that way. If we can protect the natural aquifer recharge areas, we'll have a water supply, which, oh, by the way, is important to economic development.
Sure.
And in addition to that, you've got the environmental concerns. You've got wildlife. We're very heavily working to preserve that land between the Ocala and the Osceola National Forest, our O2O program, where we can have a wildlife corridor. Wildlife does migrate north to south in Florida, because I kiddingly tell people it's kind of hard to go east to west. But nonetheless, north to south, and we want to create that corridor to give our natural wildlife places to migrate, to move about. And there's just so many other activities. In addition, in the middle of that O2O is Camp Landing. And we have a relationship with Camp Landing where we can acquire money from the federal government to help them protect their boundary. They can't expand their fence line, but we can protect their boundary so that they can train to their fence line. That allows, it really helps national security mm-hmm. in the context that they can really carry out their mission a lot better. So, and among all the things we do, we still own a fair amount of marshland. In fact, we're looking to acquire more right at the intersection of the Intercoastal Waterway and Butler Boulevard. We're looking to acquire 275 acres.
And let me ask you about that, because all of the benefits of what you do are so obvious. But as you look into the marshland areas and acquiring those pieces, how does that help mitigate against the impacts of climate change for this state over time?
Well, it not only mitigates climate change, but it also impacts flooding, hurricane damage. An acre of marsh grass, or in this case salt marsh, holds 1 million to 1.5 million gallons of flood water. That's a ton of water. I mean, that's TIA bank field filled 3 feet high. I mean, that's the way to visualize that. So it is a tremendous buffer for not only the properties around it, but for properties downriver. And it does mitigate. It stops the erosion that takes place when we have hurricanes and we have that tidal surge. It takes that momentum away from the storm itself or from the water itself. It also provides, by the way, incredible fisheries. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's where our seafood starts, is in that water. So it's habitat. It's also where they go to be safe. So it's climate change is an incredibly important issue, particularly for those of us in this area where we're seeing what they call in St. Augustine sunny day floods. St. Augustine, the city of St. Mm-hmm. Atlantic Beach calls them sunny day floods. In St. Augustine, they're finding the same thing happening.
Sure.
And the same is true and happening in Orange Beach. We've got to be prepared for these things and start looking at more creative ways of doing it. And one of them is to use nature's resources to be able to
And so with all of that said, how can people support the work of the North Florida Land Trust?
Well, in a number of ways. If they own land and are interested in either donating it or selling it to us, we're certainly open to that idea. We're more open to donations than we are to selling. But in either way, or they can certainly donate to us. Our website is available at nflt.org. November Foxtrot Lima Tango, as we used to say in the old days, .org. And there is a donation page there. They can certainly call our office while we're not occupying it full-time under the COVID restrictions. Somebody is in there all the time. We do answer the phones, and we'll be glad to get back in touch with folks. And we have a number of ways of giving. Obviously, estate planning is one of those. Certainly, we look for our major donors. In fact, we're talking to one currently about that marsh grass that we just talked about a few minutes ago.
All right.
So there's a lot of different ways.
Okay. Check it out, nflt.org. So much information, Jim, and thank you so much for stopping by. Jim McCarthy, heading up the North Florida Land Trust here in our area.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Melissa. Good to talk to you.
China wants your data and may already have it.
Most Americans have probably had their data compromised by the cyber intelligence units of the Chinese government and Chinese military intelligence.
China has collected health, financial, and travel records on millions of Americans, and maybe after your DNA info too. That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Starting at 4 on WJCT News 89.9. The new documentary, The War and Peace of Tim O'Brien, is about the Vietnam veteran who wrote one of the most acclaimed books about the war, The Things They Carried. After writing about mortality in wartime, he's now reflecting on mortality as a man in his 70s who didn't become a father until his late 50s. We'll talk with O'Brien on the next Fresh Air.
Tomorrow at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
Ida B. Wells devoted her life to lifting up those without power, and her story resonates as much today as it did in her day. Michelle Duster is a great-granddaughter of Wells, and she joins us to talk about the civil rights icon's strategies for giving a voice to the voiceless. Duster's new book is Ida B. the Queen, the extraordinary life and legacy of Ida B. Wells. That's next time on Think. Tonight at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Merrick Garland is on track to become America's new Attorney General. California needs a new one, too. It's a big job and one particularly attractive to anyone eyeing high office. One potential candidate found recent fame as chair of the House Intelligence Committee, Democratic Representative Adam Schiff, and he joins me, Jen White, next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, as we close out a pretty mild February here on the First Coast, we are pleased to share with you right now some of the Black History Month standouts that caught our eye this week. It's our What's Good Wednesdays, some positive news and notes for you. Let's begin with Groundwork Jacksonville. Their Green Team Youth Corps debuted the 400 Project, honoring the enslaved voices of Kingsley Plantation this month. This event celebrates African heritage and remembers the history of slavery at the plantation, located within the Timaquan Ecological and Historic Preserve. Now, the teens worked with Timaquan Rangers on a program to commemorate 400 years of history, ever since the first Africans were brought to the English colonies. They told the story of the plantation through the voices of six former slaves there. They wrote and recorded two simulated radio shows in collaboration with the Jacksonville Arts and Music School, and animated them and created a video allowing the teens to reflect on the experience. Very cool. Okay, a 15-year-old Springfield entrepreneur we want to give a shout out to is making national waves. Sweet Christie's is a new company that creates colorful soaps and body products in the shapes of pastries, sweets, and milkshakes. And it was founded by 15-year-old Christiana Alexander. Yes, she's 15. Now, this Black-owned business has been chosen for Curate Retail Group's Small Business Spotlight in collaboration with the National Retail Federation Foundation. That is a huge feather in her cap. She will get a lot of exposure and media coverage. So congrats to Christiana. Check out Sweet Christie's products online, too, at sweetchristies.com. And let's head over the state line up to Ravens of Elijah Food Ministries in South Georgia. Since the COVID-19 pandemic began, they have been holding drive-through food giveaways in Brunswick area every Friday afternoon, giving out about 10,000 pounds of food to well over 300 families each week. I spoke about Ravens of Elijah Food Ministries with their president and pastor, Carl Holland.
Well, Ravens of Elijah Food Ministries is a nonprofit organization that my wife and I started out of our home about 10 years ago when we'd had some financial difficulties and we just needed a little bit of help. And because of my job, there was no help available, and we decided to we were going to make an organization where people can come to us for help regardless of their situation, no questions asked. And it's grown from a few boxes out of our house to giving out over 10,000 pounds of food to over 400 families every week.
Pretty amazing. And you can learn more and find out how you can help if you go to this website, ravensofelijah.org. Well, how about this? A free four-week outdoor concert series is coming to town. Jack's River Jams will feature local and national artists on Jacksonville's North Bank Riverfront. They'll also have a small biz and artist market, food trucks, craft brews. We are all in on this. The city is trying to make use of the green space that used to be the Jacksonville Landing. These concerts will be happening in April. Check it out at jacksriverjams.com. Speaking of music, don't miss Stayin' Alive, One Night of the Bee Gees, a special tribute performance coming to the Downtown Times Union Center for one night only, tomorrow night. Stayin' Alive features a vocal trio who captures the soaring harmonies and funky beats of all the Bee Gees hits. I talked about this with one of the performers, Todd Sharman.
We kind of start at the beginning and run through and do all the fun disco stuff at the end and all the great other songs that they wrote pre-disco and actually after disco.
There's been a real Bee Gees revival lately, particularly with the recent HBO documentary featuring Barry Gibb, How Do You Mend a Broken Heart, and his new music. Meanwhile, you can get your tickets for Stayin' Alive, taking the Times Union stage tomorrow night, one night only. Go to fscjartistseries.org. And you know what? It really is an anthem for these times. We're going to close with a little Bee Gees for you. This is the song I always sing in my head when I'm trying to wash my hands for at least 30 seconds. Let's all keep staying alive. Have a great day, everyone. We'll be back tomorrow.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.